STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, dear friends. Greg Kokel here. Show is Stand to Reason, of course, and well, I'm glad to be here today. I usually am happy to be here and talk with you, but I got a buddy with me that I haven't seen for a while, and he's written a really good book. Actually, it's not his first one. It's his fourth one. His name's Ken Samples. Ken's with Reasons to Believe. He has written books like Without a Doubt, A World of Differences, Seven Truths That Change the World. I think we've had you here for most of those books in the past, but it's been a while, huh, Ken? Welcome to the show.
Have. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Greg. Yeah, you've always been very gracious in having me on your program, and I think it's probably been 10 years since we talked about A World of Difference.
So. Yeah, we were in the KBRT studios. You brought your boy by, and
He's 21 now.
So. Oh, my goodness. Well, it must have been 10 years, because he was about 11 years old, as
That's
I recall,
right. Yeah.
And wow. Well, I have you on because you do good work, and you've got a great organization. We've always had a fabulous relationship with Reasons to Believe, Hugh Ross, and the whole crew there, and you're expanding and continuing to do meaningful work. And I was actually really thrilled. I always like Reasons to Believe, but when you came on, I was glad because you came on in a very unique capacity. You're not a scientist. You're a theologian,
philosopher,
and not that they were lacking. But it really, I think, added just another dimension. It enriched their whole enterprise. And so I was glad when – how long has it been this RTB?
You know, June, it'll be 20 years
at
Reasons
my
to Believe.
Goodness.
So I remember you and I interacting just before I started working there. So
Man, that makes me feel old, brother.
I know it.
Oh, man, the time is flying, and it's flying faster than it used to. You ever notice that?
It sure seems like it.
Yeah, the days drag on and the years fly by. You know how that works. Well, let's talk a little bit about God Among the Sages. I want to talk about, let me just mention why I really like this book, because you look at Jesus and then you look at four other religious leaders reflecting four other significant world religious movements, Krishna, Confucius, Muhammad, and the Buddha. And you make some comparisons, and I think in a very charitable and accurate fashion. And so it represents for me kind of a quick study where I can go there and say, okay, now refresh my memory about some of these other religions as I'm doing comparing and contrasting. And why don't you tell us, just to start out with, Ken, why you thought this was a good book to write? What were you trying to accomplish with the book?
You know, Greg, 25 years ago, I was teaching philosophy at a public college, Cerritos College, here in Southern California. This was after my time at the Christian Research Institute, so I taught regularly world religions, logic, introduction to philosophy. And I would have, because Southern Cal is so diverse, both ethnically and religiously, I'd have Buddhists, Hindus, lots of Christians, even Muslims, and a lot of them would hang over after, you know, the final exam and say, Professor Samples, how do you sort through all this? How do you make sense of this? And they would ask me questions about Jesus, and I was always thinking to myself, I wish I had a book I could put on their hands and just say, you know, you've heard me talk about the religions, you've heard me describe them in the most careful and respectful way that I can. Now, here's where my Christian ideas come in. So that was really the beginning of this book. I never kind of lost sight of the importance of it, because even though I work at RTB, where science, faith issues are critical, I would say that question of how is Christianity true in light of the world's religions is still a very prominent question. So that was the origin of the book, and I'm really happy to see it in print. I'm going to use it as a textbook at Biola in a few weeks. excited to see it out finally.
It's nice when you could assign your own text.
I like that.
Every student in the class has to buy one of these books.
Whether you like it or not.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, and there's such a pluralistic impulse in the culture now, worse, it seems to me, than it ever has been before. Yeah. And when you start to even suggest that your view is right over some other view, then, you know, the name calling begins immediately, and it's hostile. But as I've said, you know, the idea that that all religions can't be right is just simple math. It's not bigotry. One guy said, "You must be one of those guys who think that 90% of the religions in the world are wrong." And I said, "Well, yeah, but that's not bigotry. It's just simple math. You know, they can't all be right.
They could
all be wrong, and maybe I'm wrong for the sake of discussion. But they can't all be right. But it's good that you're providing a contrast and a comparison here so that Christians can follow it and non-Christians as well. I'm just wondering, though, in your conversations through those years in secular circumstances where you have people that are in some sense identifying with Confucius or Buddha or the Hinduism, did you find that they were fairly knowledgeable about those traditions, or did you feel like they had largely kind of a pop understanding and they weren't really thoroughgoing in their understanding of those religious views?
I think that it was a very popular understanding. I think that they had some grasp of their faith, but when it came to Jesus and Christianity, it was like, well, isn't he just one more face, one more prophet? And so they were interested, though, in the question of, you know, how would Buddha and Krishna, so popular in Hinduism, how does his credentials then relate to Jesus? And I couldn't agree with you more, Greg. I think today, I mean, if you say Christianity is exclusively true, you know, you're bigoted, you're arrogant. I think that this topic has really become such an important one just for people at work, on the college campus. Can you imagine what it would be like now to debate the kinds of things you and I debated when we were in college? So this is a very relevant issue, and I think people want to know about Jesus.
Well, Jesus still has a lot of popularity in people's minds. This is why, you know, it's when you discuss the issue of, say, homosexuality, people are quick to say, well, Jesus never said anything about homosexuality. Whether this is true or not, it's interesting that why are they invoking Jesus now, you know?
Yeah.
Why should it matter what Jesus says? Well, they understand that he's somebody to contend with. And so maybe this is a good place to get into really the first section of your book, which you look at Jesus. And when people, I recommend that people respond when others are offended that they say Jesus is the only way. They say, well, that was what Jesus said. You know, it wasn't my idea. You know, if it was up to me, I'd change the rules. But those were his sentiments. This has to do with Jesus' own self-concept. So why don't you lay out a little bit for us how you would characterize, and I know most of our listeners know the theology, blah, 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 but what I would like to hear it is, Ken, how would you characterize this to a non-Christian who is asking that kind of thing? How would you begin to lay this out? What are the important features?
In the very first chapter of the book, Greg, I asked the question, you know, look, we all have a view of Jesus. I do, you do. Islam does, Krishna consciousness does. What did Jesus think of himself? Can I actually discover Jesus' own opinion? And I think that we can clearly trust the Gospels. I think there's solid evidence that they represent either eyewitness testimony or people who were close associates of the eyewitnesses.
So here you're talking about an historical document. You can trust the history that they convey.
That's right. That's right.
Without even getting into theology or inspiration, just as an account.
Exactly. The Gospels appear maybe 60 years. The epistles appear even earlier than that. There's oral tradition. I'm in a good spot to get a clear understanding of Jesus. And what we see, Greg, is that Jesus has a unique understanding of himself. And that's expressed in a couple different ways. Not only does Jesus reach into the Old Testament in a great dispute with the religious leaders of the time and refer to himself using the most sacred name of God, I am or I am he, Isaiah 45 through 48, And immediately the response is to pick up stones to stone him.
Right.
So there's a series of passages where Jesus claims to be, I and the Father, we are one. That's one way in which Jesus is conveying the idea that he sees himself as God in human flesh. But there are also other important elements. Jesus embraces and acts as if he has the prerogatives of deity,
right,
that he can forgive sin. The immediate response is, who can forgive sin but God alone?
Right.
He is able to hear and answer prayer. He receives the worship of people. Paul and Silas doesn't do that. Jesus receives their worship in a first century Jewish context. A Jewish man is allowing people to worship him. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd have to go back to the Beatles in the 60s to find somebody allowing him to worship him.
That's right.
But he also has other areas, claiming to judge humanity, mm-hmm, claiming to be able to raise the dead. And so I argue in the book that, you know, there are things that only God can do, and Jesus claims to be able to do the very things that only Yahweh can do. Mm-hmm. More than that, he uses divine titles, and he speaks of the Father in a unique way. To know me is to know the Father. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father.
Right.
Trust in me the way you would trust in Yahweh. A first century Jewish man is saying these kinds of things. So I have five different areas that I go into that demonstrate that a clear understanding of the New Testament is, mm-hmm, that Jesus saw himself as Yahweh in human flesh, mm-hmm, as an extension of Yahweh himself.
I'm glad you keep mentioning the first century context, because there is this habit, isn't there, of people to anachronistically read into those old documents common understandings of these concepts nowadays, like
right,
I and the Father are one. We're one with God, for example, or the kingdom of God is within you, or these kinds of New Agey things, and they read them back into a context that it was nothing like what they're experiencing now. These were Jews who were fiercely monotheistic,
yeah,
and understood the meaning of the texts that Jesus, yeah, himself are citing, is citing and applying them to himself.
And so instead of what Bart Ehrman and others would say, that the deity of Christ evolved over several centuries,
mm-hmm,
you know, we don't get the full deity, according to them, until we get to Chalcedon, 3rd, 4th century. Rather, the earliest statements about Jesus that come in these creedal statements, hymnal statements, Philippians 2, Colossians 1, 2 Peter. Greg, these have these enormously high Christologies,
right, right,
and they come right at the primitive form. And I use the word primitive, meaning all Jewish Christians at that point, and they're worshiping Jesus as if he's God.
I mean, the earliest characterization is what you mean by primitive. So
yes,
you're right from the very beginning,
yeah,
we have this. I'm thinking of Romans 1, which is pretty much undisputed Pauline, mid-50s or something like that. And Paul starts out by talking about this Jesus declared with power to be the Son of God,
yeah,
through the resurrection. So you've got a resurrection early on, within 20 years after. You've got the proclamation of the resurrection and a Christology.
1 Corinthians 15.
Yeah.
I mean, N.T. Wright says that creedal statement, 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 8, may have circulated within months of the resurrection,
yeah, right,
something that Paul was given by the early apostles. So that early Christology is high,
mm-hmm,
and it's powerful. And quite frankly, it's shocking when you consider the monotheistic context.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spent some time, and thankfully, in your book to actually expand a little bit on this concept, because if we just say Jesus is God, certainly in our culture and with our diverse religious understandings, people can take this in a lot of different directions. And so you spend some time talking about Chalcedonian formula and Nicaea, and maybe you can sum some of this up for us so that we can get a kind of a robust,
yeah,
without being too detailed, but a robust understanding of the classical way of understanding the person of Christ relative to his deity.
Very important, Greg, to appreciate that questions arose in the early centuries about the identity of Jesus. The Arian heresy, was Jesus of the same substance with the Father, or was Jesus a created being? the Council of Nicaea is to really hammer this down and give a presentation. And so the early church said that Jesus was a single person, but he had both a divine and human nature, and those two natures were united in that one person of Christ. Mm-hmm. And so the earliest Greek expression was Jesus was the theanthropos, theos God, anthropos man.
Right.
He's
God-man.
The God-man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this comes out by the time we get to Chalcedon, where there is a full expression of it. It's not new. This is simply a reaffirmation, a setting forth right. of what Christians had believed for several centuries.
Right. And you can go back to the textual supports for that they offered. They go right back to the very beginning. We see these yep. in the texts, and so they can be argued from the earliest expressions in the church. And I remember reading, who is the God crucified, Bauckham?
Yes, yeah, the British scholar.
And he says that, you know, the earliest, most primitive, if you will, characterization of Jesus by the church is that Jesus is Lord. And this they understood to be a characterization of the divinity of Jesus, yet at the same time a full commitment to his full humanity at the same time.
So the early church affirms that Jesus is fully God, he's fully man. And, Greg, as we move forward in church history, we begin to see a theological prism of looking at the atonement, looking at the resurrection through the incarnation. Mm-hmm. Because Jesus is God and man, he can reconcile God with humanity. Mm-hmm. Because Jesus is God, he is able to accomplish the things that he does. Mm-hmm. And so the incarnation is so critical. That's why to deny the incarnation is really to separate yourself from mm-hmm, historic mm-hmm. Christianity.
Yeah. So he's the God-man, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
It raises other questions like,
sure.
And this is something that I've wondered about myself, because how is it you've got a full human nature, you've got a full divine nature, you have one person, but you have two wills?
That's right.
Okay, so then the wills, the locus of the will, must be in the natures and not in the person. And then you also have Jesus, who sets aside the prerogatives of his divine nature and functions as a man with certain limitations as a human being. And this, yet he's still God at the same time, so he doesn't know certain things about the future.
That's right.
Which then creates problems trying to defend the notion of the deity of Christ, because surely God knows all things. So how have people, the theologians, kind of worked that out? I know you talk about it a little bit in the book,
yeah.
but this is a question that I know is going to come up in people's minds.
Well, you know, for decades now, I've had Jehovah's Witnesses knock on my door, and, you know, I usually say, look, let's time this. Let's spend 90 minutes together. You get 30, I get 30, and then we'll ask each other questions. But they'll look at various verses.
They still knock at your door, huh?
They don't know where you live.
We know this guy.
And sometimes the Mormons will come on the other evening. But I'll say to them, look, Jesus says there are certain things he doesn't know. There are times where he says the Father is greater than I.
Mm-hmm.
But remember that Jesus has a fully human nature. And as a man, he can speak of the Father as his God.
Mm-hmm.
And in that position of subordination, a submission to the Father's will, he can see the Father is greater than he.
Mm-hmm.
And so a theology, a Christian theology, is critically important as we work through Scripture to see how, you know, these doctrines interplay with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking as I was driving over here, Greg, that Jesus, in many ways, is a remarkable way not only to do evangelism, but to do apologetics mm-hmm. all at one time, because mm-hmm. soon as Jesus comes up, questions about the Trinity, questions about the atonement,
right.
God's existence, a great place to start a discussion is with Jesus.
Well, you've done a fabulous job here in your book, God Among the Sages, or God Among Sages, and in kind of laying out basic fundamental Christology in a very straightforward way that's not really complicated. Of course, there's always going to be questions. Even if you read
sure.
a massive tome on this issue,
yeah.
you still walk away with questions. But once we have our feet firmly set in solid biblical Christology, well, then we can wonder about some of these other things, but we have to have a clear view of who Jesus is first, especially when it comes to comparing what Jesus claimed about himself and what he claimed about the world to what these other major religious leaders who've had a tremendous influence in the world, what they claimed about God and who they were and how they see the world. And we'll get to that in just a moment. My guest, Ken Samples, he's author of God Among Sages, subtitled Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader. We'll get back to more conversation with my friend Ken in just a moment. Stay with us here on Stand to Reason. I have been working on one of the most important projects of my life for over a decade now, and it's finally come to press. It's called The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Now, The Story of Reality is a kind of a wide-angle view of the Christian story. It's a big-picture description of the meaning of the drama of human history. And it's meant to cover the basics of Christianity from a worldview perspective, in a voice that's really conversational, not religious. It's kind of a mere Christianity for a new generation, if that comparison doesn't seem too bold. Now, I tell the story using five words that capture the meaning of all of human history from its beginning to its end: God, man, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. The narrative, it's infused with what I call a kind of soft apologetics, that is, thoughtful reflections that are not argumentative, but rather are friendly appeals to common sense notions we're all aware of that point to the truthfulness of the Christian story. I think you'll find The Story of Reality to be, as Lee Strobel put it, a beautifully crafted description of the Christian worldview written in an accessible, winsome, and well-reasoned manner.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Greg Kokel with Dr. Ken Samples. He's the author of God Among Sages, and we're talking about his book here. And just a little biographical note, this never ceases to amaze me, but do you still read 3 to 4 hours every day as part of your standard diet?
Yeah, you know, when I was 20 years old, I wanted to serve the Lord, and I realized that I needed to commit myself, and I committed myself to getting up very early in the morning and read 3 hours every day. There have been plenty of days I haven't done it, mm-hmm. but you know, it's something that has really paid off in terms of being able to think through issues, and so reading has been a very important issue to me, not only in my personal life, but helping others to become better readers.
Well, that was very that really for me was a kind of a jaw dropper. I was in awe when you said that, because just knowing the importance of reading, but also the demands of a professional life that like we live. And but here we were talking before the show, and I just happened to mention, you know, I'm reading Ghost Soldiers right now. Oh, yes, he's nodding. Yeah, I know what that is. Yeah. And then the most controversial decision, you know, about dropping. Oh, yeah, well, I read that one. Well, I probably can't even. Do you read my books?
I do. And congratulations on your new one. It's
Thank you.
A lot of really nice things said about it by some very good people. Yeah. So congratulations.
Thank you. Well, I just gave you a copy and signed it off, so I hope you get a chance to read it some
morning,
and you'll knock it out in 3 hours, a guy like you. What we want to do is, since this book is God Among the Sages, Baker Bookhouse is your publisher on this one, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader, you contrast Jesus as a religious leader, and then we just talked a little bit about the substance of that from the historical documents. And this is important to see the way Ken is approaching this. He's not approaching this issue by saying, well, God says it, I believe it, that settles it, which is probably his sentiment in general about the authority of the Bible. Yet when he's engaging other people who don't have the same conviction, he's going back to the text as an historical text, as a reliable text in that regard, and seeing what does Jesus say about himself, and then what does he do? And so that's we're looking at Jesus in that way, and we're making a comparison. And, of course, our confidence, and I do the same thing, our confidence is that Jesus stands head and shoulders above the rest. And there's really no comparison, ultimately, in terms of accuracy and power and existential satisfaction that's coming from this. So in your book, then, after setting the foundation with who Jesus was, what he claimed, and what his self-perception was, you make comparison with four different religious leaders. And I want to ask you some questions about each one of them. Why don't we just start where you would like to start in terms of those four leaders? Tell us who the four ones were. Why did you choose those four? And I'm going to ask you some questions about their basic worldview. What do we know about the leader? And what was their basic view of reality here? So go ahead.
Yeah, I chose four. I would have liked to have maybe included one or two more, but I had to have a manageable manuscript.
Right.
You do want it to get published at some point. I chose Krishna. I then chose Siddhartha Gautama, whom the Buddhists call the Buddha, which is a title, awakened one. I then chose Confucius, an extraordinary influential moral thinker in the Chinese tradition, and then probably the most controversial religious figure among religious leader, Muhammad. So those were my four. I chose them because Hinduism is a huge religion. And Greg, I thought 10 years ago that virtually every Hindu was a pantheist. What I've uncovered is most Hindus are bhakti Hindus, and they worship one god, and that one god is Krishna. So I chose Krishna because he's the most important religious figure in Hinduism.
And as I read your book, this came clear to me. I knew that there were some monotheistic Hindus, but I did not think that they were as numerous in that. And even in my own work, I treat more the monistic version, which is popularized by a lot of New Agers, too. But anyway, it was interesting to get those refined distinctions, which is exactly what I expect from Ken Sample. So,
well, you know, the Buddha, huge figure. I mean, there are probably 400 million Buddhists in the world, but in the Eastern world, Greg, a lot of times people accept a consensus where they'll say, when it comes to after-death issues, I'm a Buddhist. When it comes to morality, I'm Confucian. When it comes to my spirituality, I'm a Taoist. Now, that's very different than saying I'm a Jew, Muslim, and Christian. But because there aren't a lot of ontological statements made there, so these individuals, I think, are hugely important and reflect a large number of people in the world.
Taoism isn't part of Confucianism, is it? Is it a subset?
It's distinct. It is distinct.
It's distinct.
They have a connection. There are stories that Lao Tzu and Confucius met each other. I'm not sure if that's the case.
But they're separate. So that was probably one of the fifth or sixth ones that you would have liked to have dealt with.
And maybe even Moses, although it just didn't quite work out.
Okay. Well, which one would you like to talk about first and why?
Let's talk about Krishna. What's interesting, Greg, that I discovered about Krishna is not only that most Hindus worship him as their god, but I also discovered that Hindu scholars don't know whether he actually existed as a historical person. And they're not all that bothered by that because mythology in their mind is a higher state than an actual historical status. But I mean, as soon as you start asking these questions, well, what do I know about Jesus? There are Jesus studies. Well, what about Krishna studies? If he existed at all, it may have been 5,000 years ago. It may be an amalgamation of individuals mixed with mythology. In terms of what I discovered about Krishna as well, is not only do we not know as much about him as we know about Jesus, but Krishna doesn't really do anything to change the status of his followers in the afterlife. And so,
there's no belief in Krishna that is salvific in any way. It isn't belief in Krishna.
That's like exactly belief, right. Okay. Yeah. And moreover, when you begin to look, I mean, Krishna is described four or five different ways. He's this dancing infant. He is this adolescent who has blue skin, who has a flute. He then is kind of this seductive guy who seduces the cow maidens, almost a playboy type. And then in the Bhagavad Gita, he's kind of a philosopher type who offers wisdom to a general who is about to engage in a battle. So I ask the question, how do we fit all of these views of Krishna together?
Yeah, what is the mythic significance, like what he represents in the religion? What does he do for the religion, so to speak?
Well, in some sense, there's no coherent kind of bringing together these ideas, although they would say you can think of them metaphorically. Think of the playboy Krishna is kind of your lover, if you will, or think of the philosopher type as, you know, the intellectual kind of element. I never found, however, a convincing discussion. I mean, how can Hindu ethics forbid illicit sexual relations when the Krishna figure is engaged and violates those kinds of principles? So when it comes to what we know about him, when it comes to his moral nature, when it comes to what did he do that I should put all of my confidence in him, he doesn't relate well to Jesus. And and as you've pointed out, there's no second place. Jesus is above the rest. And in some ways, not so much with Krishna, but with the Buddha and Confucius, I actually felt kind of a
kinship,
an appreciation for them, because both of them said that they were broken human beings, that they couldn't keep the moral principles that they advocated. And I thought, wow, I see them as human. But even the great religious leaders, Greg, it's not just you and I that have trouble when we compare ourselves with Jesus. Nobody compares well with Jesus.
So if one were to ask Krishna, what must I do to be saved, as the Philippian jailer asked Paul, what would be the answer?
I think they would say that you are to commit yourself to a loving, devoted relationship. You're to chant the name, the mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Rama, 1,000 times a day. You are to offer offerings to him and fill your consciousness with him. But there's no guarantee. There is no there's no assurance that everything you do in this life is necessarily going to break that karmic debt and ensure that things will be good in the afterlife.
So that was the question I was going to ask. What do these things that they're supposed to do, how do they, or what do they accomplish, or how do they affect whatever problem it is that is keeping someone from salvation? Because you got creation, fall, redemption, restoration. Every worldview has a beginning and an ultimate reality. Then something goes wrong, and then the solution is dependent on what went wrong. So what is, on the from Krishna's perspective, what went wrong? What's our problem, and therefore what is the solution?
Yeah, you have an interesting philosophical model here. You have this idea of karma, which is kind of built in this moral law of cause and effect. What comes around goes around, etc. And this is kind of built into the nature of the universe. But this isn't rooted, Greg, in the nature of God. You think of Christianity, moral values flow out of the very moral nature of God. This karmic debt is built into the universe, and it's rather impersonal. So Krishna doesn't have a guarantee that you're going to break that karmic debt and experience some kind of union with God in the afterlife. It's wanting in terms of, why should I make my commitment? Of course, I think it's great that we can begin to talk with Hindus and say, look, you worship Krishna. You see him as a kind of savior. I see Jesus as a savior. Let's talk about the common ground we have, and then let's do a little comparing here. Mm-hmm. I think I have something in Jesus I can offer you that puts him in a position that's going to greatly benefit you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another question I have is what reason do we have to think that what Krishna, whoever he was, offers is sound, is reliable? What are the reasons to believe that that whole characterization is true? And how would a Hindu respond to that?
I think these are very challenging issues for a Hindu to think about. What is the logical structure of their belief system? If Krishna didn't exist, if this is mythological in nature, it seems to me that Hinduism is very high on meditation, but very low in terms of kind of rationality in answering these mm-hmm. kinds of questions. It is a mystical religion, after all, yeah. And that mysticism can extend beyond reason and rationality. Mm-hmm. As a person who studies logic, a person who talks about worldview, Hinduism doesn't score well on issues like the coherence test.
But somebody would have, it just seems to me, and we'll have to move on to some other leaders in a moment, but it just seems to me that no matter what religious system one follows or leader one follows, a person has got to answer the question, since so much is at stake. This is a worldview, after all. Why should I believe that this is the way the world actually is? Yeah. You can have mystical experiences in Christianity. You have mysticism as well. But there's an answer to that question, you know. But why would anybody believe, and maybe it's not offered, maybe it's just, you know, experiencing it and that's all they can offer, you know. I guess Christianity is unique in providing apologetics for their view.
Well, there definitely isn't anything that Krishna does that can be compared to an atonement, to a sacrifice.
Yeah.
You can maybe experience mystical delight in that intense kind of relationship you have with Krishna. But ontologically, looking at the afterworld, Krishna doesn't do anything mm-hmm. that's going to fundamentally change your relationship mm-hmm. with God or with whatever it is that comes afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a break here, Ken, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the Buddha. I think he's next on your list. All right. I'm not sure if we're going to get to Confucius. We'll see, or we'll just see. You know, if we leave some out, then people have to buy the book, won't they?
There you go.
Okay. All right. My guest, Ken Samples, and his book, his latest, God Among Sages, Why Jesus Is Not Just Another Religious Leader. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
Students, who's waiting for you? Parents, pastors, who is waiting for your students? When they leave the safety of your home or your church, who will they encounter? What kind of challenges will they face? The fact is that the majority of our young people are not ready for the intellectual and moral challenges they'll face, not only on the college campus, but on the high school campus or junior high campus, and that is why they need to go to Rethink. Bring your students to the Rethink Apologetics Student Conference in Birmingham, Alabama on April 21st and 22nd. Go to rethinkapologetics.com for more information.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what Scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like. ¶¶
Coco back with you here at Stand to Reason. And my guest, Ken Samples. We're talking about his book, God Among Sages, and just wanted to let you know that that's available at Stand to Reason. In fact, you can get it at str.org. You can get the book and the CD of our conversation together. So we're just packaging that together to make a value added for you. And you can just go to str.org, and that will be featured. Is that up already? Is that yeah, it's up already. So certainly by the time you guys listen to this, it'll all be there. All right, go to the homepage, click on the store, and that's where you'll find God Among Sages, Kenneth Richard Samples. Ken, we were talking about the different religious leaders here, and let's talk about the Buddha a little bit. What my question, I guess, would be the same as I had for the others. What do we know about the leader, and what was his basic view of the world? What's the problem and the solution?
Yeah, you know, Greg, as influential as Islam is, and I mean, the number I see from the Pew Report, maybe 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, they estimate 3 billion by 2050. But I would say this, Greg, I think philosophically speaking, Buddhism is the greater challenge to the Christian worldview. Hmm. The reason I say that is because the Buddha begins with this question of pain and suffering in the world. How do we explain it? How can we somehow navigate through this world that's filled with sorrow? And because you don't have to have a god, Theravada Buddhism, the original form, doesn't have a belief in a deity. Buddhism evolves and Buddha becomes a deity along with many others, but that's Mahayana Buddhism. Mm-hmm. That comes down the pipe.
So it's not, it is a non-theistic religion.
It is a non-theistic religion. A lot of intellectuals are attracted to it. It has meditation. It has seemingly a sense of morality, but you have no moral god who's kind of looking down at you, making judgments. The Buddha, of course, is born in India. There are virtually very few Buddhists in India anymore. Hmm. They've been overcome by both Muslims and Hindus. Mm-hmm. But the Buddha
begins in Southeast Asia. Then I lived in Thailand. That's a Buddhist country.
Southeast Cambodia, Asia, deep influence of Buddhism. So the Buddha argues that life is filled with suffering, the Four Noble Truths. Life is filled with suffering. Suffering is caused by a desire or a craving for temporal things that are passing away. The only way to stop the suffering is to stop the craving or desiring. And the only way you can prepare for that ultimate nirvana, whatever that is, it is mysterious, is to follow the Eightfold Path, where you would change the way you think, the way you meditate, change the way you live, the way you reason, kind of a transformation of the total person, mm-hmm. so that you can move away from that path of desire and attachment.
Well, I can see the kinship there, or at least the parallel, maybe not kinship, with many aspects of Christianity. I do have a question, though, about nirvana, just very quickly. My understanding is the word nirvana actually means extinction. Yeah. And my question is it referring to the extinction of the self or the extinction of suffering or both?
Terrific question, because Buddhists don't believe in an eternal soul.
Right.
They would argue that belief in that eternal soul is part of that attachment
that
brings all of that, you know, bad experience that you have. It does mean extinction. It can mean kind of blowing out of the craving, if you will. It could potentially mean the extinction of self altogether. Buddhism is a very complicated philosophical system, so much so that the divisions within Buddhism are much more complex and have many more differences than anything we find in the denominations within Protestantism.
Huh. Hmm.
You have many different evolving systems of Buddhism. And so understanding some of those ideas of exactly what nirvana is, I mean, there is a sense in which they'll say mystically, those who say don't know and those who know don't say.
Yeah.
But it does
it's
seem
like
to be...
If you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
That's right. It does, though, seem to be a conscious state in this life, because the Buddha experienced nirvana before he had died.
Huh.
So it seems to be more of a mental conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all of the factors that relate to that, they don't believe that the soul is reincarnated. There are certain qualities that carry over. But when I look at those qualities that they talk about that are carried over in some kind of reincarnation, it sounds like the soul to me.
Yeah, right, right, which they don't believe.
Which they don't believe in.
Yeah, which is... It just strikes me as odd. So how would you suggest that, given this basic understanding of Buddhism, how would you suggest the Christian then approached the Buddhist?
I think it's important to maybe bring up a few things we touched on with Krishna. Number one, Greg, Buddhist scholars do not know what century the Buddha was born in. I mean, there are traditional dates born in the 6th century, but
BC.
It could be a century earlier. It could be a century or more later. I mean, Christians debate. There are historical questions, scholarly questions about the exact year Jesus is born, mm-hmm. or whether he died in 30 or was it 33. Mm-hmm. The Buddhists don't know what century he was born in. Mm-hmm. The documents about his teaching and his life come 400 years after his death.
Hmm.
So when we talk about, you know, maybe Galatians is 17 or 18 years after the death of Jesus, and we talk about, you know, the Gospels maybe 60 years, in Buddhism we're talking 4 centuries mm-hmm. later. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have some good information, because they had oral tradition.
Right.
And they had a way of conveying ideas. But when it comes to what we know about the Buddha, far less than what we know about Jesus. In terms of his moral nature, the Buddha is very candid that he was not a perfect person. In fact, he describes himself as a broken person. Mm-hmm. I felt a kinship with mm-hmm. him. I thought, why am I sympathetic to the Buddha? But I was. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what does the Buddha do? Can he guarantee you? Can he take your hand and take you to nirvana? No, his last commandment before he died was work out your salvation with great diligence. Mm-hmm. Buddhism is high on discipline, but again, it doesn't seem to have a lot of assurances mm-hmm. that things are going to work out well for you in the next life.
Right.
Or you may, Greg, you may be reincarnated a billion times.
Mm-hmm.
A billion times.
You know, when I was in India...
How many times can I be a Laker fan?
I mean, I know. When I was in India a number of years ago, it was probably 20 years ago now, I think about it, but they had posters of these avatars or whatever
right.
that claimed to be reincarnations of Jesus. And it
right.
is interesting that you could have multiple people at the same time making this claim, for one. But it struck me that this does not commend that religious view to me very effectively, because Jesus was pretty cool. I mean, he was like perfect, right?
That's
but
right.
But if he's still stuck in the system 2,000 years later, man, what hope does that give for me, you know?
You got it.
Yeah, so that's not very encouraging. You could have, like you said, a billion reincarnations. So so this I'm trying to think of the question I was going to ask you. Is there any reason? We know that the historical details about Buddha's life are not as critical as about Jesus, because as you pointed out, it's not really about his person. It's about the teaching that he conveys yeah. about the way the world is. And anybody could convey that. He just famously was the first one, maybe, of this particular thing. But is there, where Jesus is different, you know, Jesus matters. If he didn't exist, we have no Christianity.
Right.
He's the Savior, not just the teacher. But is there any reason that we have, then, to think that this particular way of, or that they give us, this way of seeing the world is accurate?
I think Buddhism has some positive elements. Certainly, you're probably not likely to get on an airplane with Buddhists and they'll blow it up. I mean, Buddhists tend to be peaceful. They tend to be reflective uh-huh. individuals. That's a very positive thing in a world of terrorism. On the other hand, do I have this right vision? Am I looking at the world rightly? You know, there is no ultimate answer to... you know, the problem of suffering. You can say nirvana, but there are times Buddhists seem to contradict themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Life is suffering. It seems to kind of come without end, and yet nirvana stops it. So there are times from a logical point of view, I'm not sure there is kind of a coherent model that runs all the way through
mm-hmm.
it. nevertheless, it's a place I think we can begin to talk about pain and suffering and why that is so significant in our lives and how Jesus would compare with Buddha in terms of maybe solving some of these kinds of problems.
Right. Well, there's an existential appeal in that if it talks about suffering and pain, this is something we are all familiar with and we know is real. And so at least at this point, it's resonating with an intuition that we already have about the nature of the world. And Christianity does the same here. It takes evil seriously. It doesn't pretend like it's a figment of our imagination, you know, it is just emotivism or something like that. No, it's real. And so I think here we have some kinship, and I think you talk about it in the book about finding common ground, in especially in a case of Buddhism. There's a lot of common ground that we have, although maybe you want to answer this. I did raise the question, we're not going to get too Confucius, I'm looking at the clock, whether the morality of Buddhism is a genuine morality or not, or is it just a kind of consequentialism, like here are the five things that you shouldn't be doing so that you can get to this goal more quickly. In my mind, this is different from saying, you know, these behaviors are immoral because they offend a moral God.
Right.
You know, and so I brought that up at the break, but I wasn't sure if you thought about that.
I think you're onto something important there. I mean, when philosophers talk about ethics, we talk about this ought, we talk about this should, this prescriptive, not merely a descriptive, but prescriptive.
Right.
But we also talk about, is it virtue ethics?
Right.
We talk about various elements. I think there is kind of an impersonal cause and effect because it's not just Hindus. Buddhists also talk about these kind of karmic elements. So I think you've raised a very good question about how would Christian ethics relate to Buddhist ethics in terms of, is there a will of an individual that makes authentic choices and builds actual character? Or is it merely kind of a response, in some ways kind of a passive response? I'm just kind of trying to sidestep the problem of pain and suffering in the world.
Right, yeah, that's what it seems like to me. We got 5 minutes here. So who do you want to do, Confucius or Muhammad in 5 minutes?
I'll let you decide.
I'd like to hear about Muhammad. And only because I think that is probably more of an interest to the audience.
Sure.
Though, Confucius is a fascinating individual. Has
By
massive
the way,
influence.
Confucius may have been a theist. There is a whole field of research.
Well, if they want to find out about what
That's
you
right.
think about it, they can read the book God Among Sages. What do you want to say here in four minutes?
I want to say in terms about Muhammad, there is one author, a man named Hart, who wrote a book, The 100, compares the 100 most influential people in the world. He picks Muhammad one. I wouldn't have done it. Number one. I think Jesus is... profound influence is much deeper.
And he has a 600 year head start on Muhammad, too.
That's exactly right. But when you consider that, here's Hart's argument, Muhammad is the only one to found a world religion and be a governor, a political leader, and be a military leader within that system. Typically, the way we chart people is, are they a politician? Are they a military leader? What would I say about Muhammad? I would say he was born into the Middle Ages, the Arabian desert. He's an orphan. He can't read or write. But within 60 years, he becomes the greatest influential figure in the Arabian world. He must have been incredibly intelligent, had a fierce will. But what we discover about him when he gets power, he's ruthless. He's not a perfect man, never claimed to be God, and he admits his own brokenness. By the way, he's also, I think, very honest that these visions, the things he hears in the cave above Mount Hira,
that resulted in the Quran,
he has a lot of doubts in the beginning. In fact, he says that it may be some kind of false spirit happening there. Muhammad is an extraordinary person in history, but when we look at what we know about him, we don't know nearly as much about him, even though he's born in 570, dies 632. We don't know as much about him. We don't have nearly the manuscript abundance. Uthman burned a lot of the early copies of the Quran.
The Quran says more about Jesus than it does about Muhammad.
Interesting point. So we don't know much about Muhammad as compared with Christ. In terms of his nature, he's a broken, fallen person like everybody else except Jesus. And does Muhammad do anything, Greg, to ensure that you're going to make paradise? No, your deeds are going to be put on that scale, and you have no mediator. Muhammad is not a mediator. No original sin, no atonement in Islam. Muhammad, I think, a very extraordinary person, but far from a perfect person. And so, you know, Muslims kind of say he's the holiest individual. They kind of treat him as what would Muhammad do. But what we discover is that he attacked caravans. Mm-hmm. Under his will, men, women, and children were killed. And we also know that he had multiple wives after his first wife with Khadijah. And he kind of acted immorally in many different ways in that context. So we don't have to beat up Muhammad. Just place him beside Jesus. Mm-hmm. That will put all things in its place.
And these things that you mentioned are all part of the record.
Yes.
That Muslims offer regarding Muhammad himself. So
in the Quran.
Right, in the literature of the Muslims. It's, wow. We could go another hour, Ken. I'm sorry. My apologies to Confucius. But, of course, it's all in the book. You have extensive treatments that are accessible and very, very charitable. I love your spirit.
Thank
in
you.
The book, Ken. You deal with the facts. You represent things accurately. It's your style. It's your ethic. It's ours, in fact. And we don't want to distort the truth. We don't need to.
Right.
We can represent other people's point of view accurately and then put Christ against those other leaders, whether
yes.
it's Muhammad or Confucius or Buddha or the other guy, Krishna.
and how disappointing it is when our faith is misrepresented.
Uh-huh.
I never want to misrepresent what other people
yeah.
believe. Golden rule of apologetics, treat other people's beliefs
yes.
the way you want yours treated.
Yes, absolutely. My guest has been Dr. Ken Samples. His book, God Among Sages, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader. If you want an accurate characterization of those four religious leaders that I just mentioned, the Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad, and Krishna, compared to Jesus, and this is an orthodox, careful, solid, foundational, non-theologically controversial view of Jesus. In fact, you're going to get the solid stuff when you read Ken Samples. If you want that comparison, then God Among Sages is for you. Ken, thanks so much for being part.
Thank you, Greg.
Yeah, it's great having you. All right, friends, that's it for Stand to Reason. Just remember, that book and the CD of this broadcast is available at our bookstore at str.org. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye, friends.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.